Well, I'm pleased to be joined this afternoon by Professor Mark Nason of the African American Studies and History Department at Fordham University. Welcome, Professor Nason.
I was glad to be here.
Well, we thought we would talk to you a bit about what's in the news today in the last couple of days, the George Zimmerman trial and what it has to say about, justice in Florida for this young man, Trayvon Martin, and a lot of the questions that still surround it. Now, is this been a case that you've been following with some interest?
This has been a preoccupation of me and many people that I work with in New York City, not only, my colleagues in my department, but many young activists and community leaders around the city. It's not just the Florida issue that makes this so poignant. It's that young men of color feel at risk all over the country. And in New York City, we have the whole issue of stop and frisk, which has disproportionately affected young men of color. So any time someone is killed who is unarmed and just, going to the store by somebody who has the imprimatur of legal authority, it touches such a powerful nerve in the black community that it's almost indescribable the pain that people are feeling right now. Because they say, this could be my son, this could be my boyfriend, this could be my grandson, this could be me. I am Trayvon. I'm white. I'm not Trayvon Martin, but tens of millions of people around the country feel they are Trayvon Martin, and they feel a lot more vulnerable after this verdict.
Now, do you have a sense? Unfortunately, the case is that there are many young African Americans who die in the streets, and yet this one drew so much attention.
It's very different when you are killed by someone who has some connection to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different than being killed by a stray bullet shot by somebody, who's involved in illegal activity. Because you want to feel that the government and the law protect you. And when the law becomes your enemy, who do you turn to? That's why this case touches such a powerful chord. Much like the Amadou Diallo case in the Bronx 13 years ago, where four police officers shot, put 41 bullets in an unarmed African immigrant. When law enforcement murders an innocent person who is unarmed, it makes every young black person feel that could be me, and I can't trust government to protect me the way other citizens feel they can. It creates a these incidents create a profound racial divide in our society, and anybody who thinks that isn't true is not really listening to what their African American neighbors, coworkers, and friends are saying. I cannot tell you how deep the rage and pain is right now all over this country.
It's interesting, a related case, a little bit different, but the Central Park Five, where you had, five African Americans, Hispanic youth who were arrested mm-hmm. and charged for a crime they did not commit. And I attended a screening of that film where a lot of African-American parents were there and were very concerned, asking questions about how do we prevent this from happening to our children. So
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of worry out there that, they could lose their children to violence, to, a corrupt system.
Yeah, here you have an incident where this young man, it's the NBA playoffs, he's going to the store to get some snacks, and he ends up being shot and killed by, somebody who is a block captain. Now, I have been someone on block security. When I moved to Park Slope in 1976, this was a really tough neighborhood. And groups of teenagers, who are actually mostly white, would come on the block and sometimes, you know, beat up people or occasionally, you know, break into cars. And because I grew up kind of in a really tough neighborhood and I'm a big guy, I joined with people in the, and I said, I'm going to put a stop to this. So I basically walked up to these kids and said very politely, you know, you're not going to do this anymore. And they looked at me, I looked at them, and that was that. Now, Trayvon Martin was not there to do anything, but in that, I've been in those kind of encounters, you know, where I've been like in security in a gymnasium or at a dance in very tough neighborhoods. There's a body language that is appropriate in that situation between the person in authority and the young person you're talking to. You have to be polite. You have to treat them with respect. You have to look them in the eye. And you have to comport yourself in a way that they will respect you. And none of that happened here. This was handled about as badly as you could handle it, and the person had a gun. Anybody knows who deals with teenagers, don't back them into a corner because they won't back down. Anybody who's worked in a tough high school, anybody who's run gyms the way I have, you know, in where I've had kids from Red Hook and Prospect Heights and Sunset Park as well as Park Slope when it was a tough neighborhood, you don't back kids into a corner. There's a way to do this. And this guy did everything exactly wrong, and he had a gun. And a young man was just unarmed young man ends up being killed. And does race enter into it? Has anybody ever heard of a white kid being killed in that situation? That's what, you know, black families around the country are asking. Why does this kind of thing only happen to young black men?
And the injustice they feel here also has to do with what steps happened afterwards, obviously,
right.
In terms of
yeah.
that, you know, I think it was the New York Times op-ed today said if the racial roles were reversed, it's very likely that the perpetrator would still be in jail, you know, if a white child was killed.
But also it took, I think, 47 days for there to be an arrest.
Right.
Then you have an all-white jury. And it's clear from some of the juror comments, they totally identified with George Zimmerman. And they, you know, they saw Trayvon Martin as a threat, and George Zimmerman as someone who was one of them protecting his neighborhood. I mean, and what do you think that says to black families? That their children have no capacity to elicit any kind of empathy and understanding from a significant number of white people in this country. It sends a chill through them.
And obviously, I mean, we're at a time where obviously we have an African-American president. He said if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. So he was trying to establish that empathy or at least show people that connection, but...
Yeah, there isn't that much, and there are people who have no empathy for having a black president either.
Yeah.
You know, so that's another... issue here. This exposes some profound racial divides in this country that are still very difficult to bridge. I've been trying to bridge them by writing things, you know, where I try to explain, you know, especially to white people, why this verdict is so upsetting to black people, and also why George Zimmerman's actions are just so wrong. You know, I've written it from the perspective of a block captain who has dealt with kids, you know, much tougher than Trayvon Martin, you know, and never had a gun and never even ended up in a violent incident, because there is a way to talk to young people in these situations. And you know, and George Zimmerman did everything wrong. Yeah, and then he had a gun, and then the laws of Florida defend him using the gun. You chase down a young man, corner him, provoke him to hit you, and then you shoot and kill him. A just astonishingly awful scenario for me as somebody who has been in George Zimmerman's shoes. You know, as somebody patrolling a block where there have been robberies.
Well, it seems as, you know, obviously the gun makes it lethal. And
Well, that's another reason you should never have a private security person like that carrying a gun in those situations. Because if things do go wrong, you know, then somebody dies. But also, do you really want somebody that insecure and, you know, so filled with fear and rage being the one patrolling your neighborhood? I mean, you know, maybe, you know, what happens is the only people who ever do it are the ones who volunteer, and people don't look too closely. But this was a catastrophe in so many different dimensions, and now we have a huge portion of the country who feel hurt, alienated, mistrustful of government, and fearful for their children. It's pretty awful.
All those things being true, there have been protests, there have been responses, yeah. People are angry, but you know, there were some out there in the media who were thinking that it was going to be much worse, that if he was acquitted, there could be riots. But that hasn't developed, but it kind of tells you something about the fears that still exist maybe among some whites about what could happen as a result of something like this happening.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really expect there to be riots. First of all, I think almost every major protest has been thoroughly multiracial. You know, and that a lot of whites feel outraged. I also think that we're a more multiracial country than we were in the 60s in terms of many people are parts of multiracial families. I have a black granddaughter. And this, so that there are these connections that cross racial lines that do mitigate some of the rage. But I wouldn't be totally overconfident that, you know, no violence will ever result from this. I think we've been, you know, fortunate so far, but I don't want to predict that the worst is over with this. There's a lot of festering rage and is unresolved. And as the more people talk to each other, the angrier they get about this.
Now, this came a couple of weeks after, I mean, from a legal perspective, you've got the Voting Rights Act,
mm-hmm.
part of that being struck down, a lot of questions about how far we've progressed as a country in terms of race
right.
relations. So, and then this happened. So is there some
and
lingering
the
anger
action,
there?
The affirmative action decision as well.
Yes.
I think that part of the Supreme Court, you know, logic of the majority positions, we're now a post-racial society. And the measures that we needed, the race-conscious measures we may have needed in the 60s and 70s are no longer necessary. You know, I personally think that's a highly questionable proposition, especially given the disproportionate number of young black and Latino men in prison. Who have been in prison, who continue to be, you know, trapped in poverty, which is not to say that, you know, there isn't a significant and growing level of white poverty in this country as well, or that these issues, you know, don't cross racial lines. But, you know, there's a concept in jurisprudence called disparate impact, which is when a pattern of activity so disproportionately affects one group that has suffered discrimination, even if the intent of the law or the practice is not discriminatory, it should be considered discrimination. So if stop and frisk in New York City touches a black young man, you know, 9 times more than a white young man, that would be considered under disparate impact a form of discrimination, even though the police say that they are not using race as an indicator of who they stop. So that's the issue. When there are you know, there's such a disproportionate number of, you know, black men in jail. Is that discrimination? And everybody said, well, there will be people who say race has nothing to do with it. Just as people will say what happened to Trayvon Martin, race had nothing to do with it. That's a tough sell to many African Americans right now. It's a very tough sell that race had nothing to do with Trayvon Martin's death or George Zimmerman's acquittal.
Now, you mentioned the Amadou Diallo case. Of course, you look back to, you know, the O.J. Simpson trial, the before that, the riots in L.A. I mean, periodic times where questions of race come up for topic of national conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something different about this conversation?
I think a couple of things are very different, and some of them have to do with why there aren't riots. First of all, we have something going on in this country called demographic inversion, which is the poor are increasingly being pushed out of the cities into the suburbs, and that changes the logistics of a riot. You know, when the poor are scattered through suburban communities, the concentration necessary for like the kind of riots you saw in L.A. Or we saw in the 60s just aren't there anymore. Secondly, yes, we have many more multiracial families than we had even 20, 30 years ago. Immigration has changed the ethnic composition of the whole country, and there are a lot of immigrants of color who don't have the same, you know, sense of historic grievance that, let's say, African Americans might have. So all of this means that the chances are that, you know, you're not going to have the kind of riots that you had after Rodney King's beating, or we had in the 60s. But you still have this sense that, you know, African Americans and, to a lesser degree, Latinos are dealt with differently by law enforcement, dealt with differently in schools, dealt with differently in the job market, especially if they aren't identifiably upper middle class. And this is one of the other conversations. I mean, there was an interesting article in the Times today, and there was an article posted on the internet about how the lesson of Trayvon Martin is, if you're black, you better dress white. You know, you can't afford, you know, to wear casual clothes and have a hoodie, you know, on a rainy night, because then you're going to be identified as a danger and subject to all kinds of profiling, from being followed in a store, for people having aversion reactions to you, to being stopped and frisked by the police, to having your car stopped, or in the worst instance, being, you know, confronted and shot and killed. In other words, that if you're in public space and you're black, you have to always watch your P's and Q's, because you're going to be easily misinterpreted as a potential criminal if you don't take measures in how you dress and comport yourself to challenge that. And that's a burden that, you know, white people don't face. Think of the stress levels that puts on African Americans, that you're leaving the house, you've got to always be ready for that kind of aversion reaction to you, which can be anywhere from annoying to dangerous to deadly. You know, it's the kind of thing that takes years off people's lives. You know, there are these terms. Have ever you heard it? DWB, driving while black, WWB, walking while black. And I coined a new term, dying while black, because I find the life expectancy of my black middle-class friends and colleagues is probably 5 or 7 years shorter than that of my white friends and colleagues, because I would guess, because of race-related stress. These are things that, you know, it's very uncomfortable for us as a society to grapple with. But I don't think anything I'm saying couldn't be confirmed by somebody who, you know, having honest conversation with their black friends and colleagues, if they're not black. In the black community, they're all discussed constantly.
Is that potentially one of the lessons or the takeaways here, is that maybe that conversation can happen, that's been taking place just within the black community, or are there any other lessons here?
Well, I think the problem is, I've tried to have this conversation with whites, and a number of them, especially those who have black children or black spouses or, you know, work in, you know, in schools teaching youngsters like Trayvon, get it. And there are other people who just totally, what they end up doing is putting Trayvon on trial and saying he brought it on himself. And Zimmerman's life was in danger. You know, again, I don't think there is a lot of identification with Trayvon Martin outside of people in the black community, whites who work in the black community or have black, you know, parts of multiracial families. It's pretty ugly. Some of the conversations I've been in, you know, on a couple of websites where I've posted things, they've been pretty ugly and angry. I would not say that my last 3 days have been a very optimistic experience blogging and talking about this. It's been really rough.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens over the next few days and in the coming weeks, but hopefully the conversation will continue in a productive manner on
at
least in some places.
And we will continue it in our department and at our university, I can tell you. That, you know, I mean, Fordham is a place where these conversations can take place, at least in a number of our classes, and it's one of the reasons I love teaching there.
Well, Jesuit University in the heart of the Bronx, it's a good place to have those conversations. So.
Absolutely.
Well, Professor Mark Nason, thank you so much for taking some time, and we hope to talk to you again.
Okay, thank you very much.